Welcome one, welcome all, step right up, ladies and gentlemen, Portal Gaming Podcast, episode number 135, coming at you right now. Howdy, everybody. Portal Gaming Podcast, a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. It's a podcast brought to you by a store called The Portal, which is located in Manchester, Connecticut. And for more information, you can log on to www.timemachineportal.com. Check us out on Facebook, The Portal, and on Twitter, at PortalGaming60. This is episode number 135, entitled Everybody Wants a Happy Ending, right? But it doesn't always roll that way. Awesome. I am your host, The Brant, and with me is...
Your co-host, Brian.
And we are bringing you episode 135. We're going to review a bunch of games, and then we're going to talk about Tapestry, the big new game. I'm sorry, we're not reviewing. We're going to talk about
that,
Tapestry.
Yeah.
We didn't get a copy of Tapestry, but we're going to talk about that from Stonemaier Games. So how's everything going, Brian?
Yeah, it's going well. I know we're not driving this time, so
that's right.
Good.
Yeah.
A little easier that way, but yeah, no, getting back in the swing of things. Now it's heading into fall, so everything's kind of shifting gears. School is starting up, so it's just a little bit more, I don't know, it's a little more structured, and there's a lot more that we have to figure out for scheduling coming up for the next few months as well.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's been good. I mean, the weather's nice right now. It's kind of in that lull, like in between, where it's decent outside and, you know, but it's not getting to the point where it's like, you know, rough to be outside or inside or anything like that. So,
yeah, I'm back at school.
Yeah.
So I'm teaching, and it's generally good, but it's always like, yeah, I'm ready, no problem. And then like a weekend, it kicks your butt. You're just so tired. Like you forget about just the regular. And it sounds funny to people who work all year round and just don't really, you know what
right.
I mean? But when you're used to that, like, go, 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 stop, you know, go,
yeah.
That startup again is a little tricky. But it's not too bad. It's nothing that I like would complain about. But it's just like, oh, I have to remember that I'm changing gears. And it's different in terms of that. I was on the Family Gamers podcast. I was on that podcast, which also member of the Dice Tower Network, with Anitra and Andrew. And basically, I just reviewed kids' games, family games,
because right.
That's what they talk about. But we did conversation. We talked about teaching. We talked about the store and just kind of the origins of the podcast, just saying it was like, Brant, just go do unique stuff. And I was like, well, there's no stores with podcasts. You were like, do that. So we did it. And here we are, 135 episodes later, still doing it. So, but people could check that out. That's the Family Gamers podcast. I was on their episode. So
nice.
That was fun. And thank you to them for having me on. And then, I don't know, did you listen to the most recent Dice Tower episode by any chance?
Which one was that? That was the
letter G,
yeah.
G's for game.
Yep.
Did you hear Jeff Engelstein? Did you hear that part? He talked about Hexapawn. All right, so he was talking about a tic-tac-toe and how you could program tic-tac-toe, but then there was an easier version. It literally not even writing a program on like code on a computer, but like a manual program. You could make a manual bot.
Yeah.
And my school has asked us to
do
not that. Necessarily do less curriculum, but just think about where in the curriculum could we fit in projects. And
after
like
they
that.
Listen to the Dice Tower podcast?
That's right, yes.
Right.
So I went and I proposed the idea of doing this Hexapawn project. So we're going to do that. We're going to play Hexapawn in the class, and then we're going to program robots manually. And then, I don't know, write about them or perhaps create our own game and then talk about how we could program. What's really important in my school is process over product, which is very similar to Epic Arts.
Right.
And just learning in general. So the idea is that they could create a game and they could come up with the base idea for creating a robot. But when the permutations get too large, you need to make hundreds of something or thousands of something. We couldn't actually implement that, but
right.
They could at least talk about how they would do that. So
just getting it started up.
I have no idea if it's going to work, but hey, it's fun try. So I'm looking to do that in November. I contacted Jeff to let him
right.
know,
oh,
and
that's awesome.
We'll see what happens. So that's kind of interesting.
You're excited for that?
Yeah. I'm intrigued by it.
Right.
I like the idea that I'm learning alongside the students, right? Because that's not something that most teachers or people would think about. Like the teacher knows all and the students know nothing and you teach them all your information. is fine. Like, that's a general, but I would like, I don't know the, I don't know if this will work, right? Let's see if it works. Let's learn it together. Of course, then once I do it for 2 or 3 years, if I do, then I'll know it all. I'll have to change it up, but should be kind of fun. So thanks to Jeff for that idea. Hey, we should review games because it's post-Gen Con, and that's basically what we do.
Because that's all we've been playing.
So we're going to go all the way back. We're going to go to the DC deck building game, the new one, Rebirth. And this is from Cryptozoic Games. So DC deck building has kind of had an up and down reputation in terms of that. What is that system called? Something like Mind or Cranio? Something. Cranio. I don't know. There's some name for that system.
Yeah, I'm completely blanking out.
Yeah. But so they have kind of a, you know, put the cards out in the row and then you buy the cards. There's one power. Some of the things people didn't like thematically was you would beat villains and they'd go in your deck. And, you know, you could just kind of get random powers for random people, whatever. So they totally redid the game. It is now a co-op. Oh, let's not call it a legacy game. Well, it's just campaign, I guess, right? You just open little packs to add things through. So we got a chance to play it kind of ish at Gen Con, and then we played 2 games.
Yeah, I think so, after we got back.
After we got back, maybe 3. Maybe I played one at the store. I can't remember. So what they've changed is it's now, like, your characters have a pawn, and the deck or the cards that come out are placed in a loop that you can travel around with locations. And then the villains come out, and you just beat the villains. So and then you travel to locations to draft or purchase the cards that you're going to put in your deck. So basically, this is the idea. There's a little track that it moves up, and you shuffle in supervillains. Are they called supervillains?
I think so, yeah.
And they're basically shuffled, like, 2 per deck throughout. And most of the ones we played was, like, defeat 5 supervillains. So they need to come out of the deck along with all the other cards. They will attack you at the start of their turn. They'll try to move towards the location they're getting to. If they get to that location, they'll attack everybody at the start of their turn. And it's various effects from discard a punch card to remove a card from your deck to discard a random card, all sorts of effects. I guess lots of losing cards, which makes sense in a deck builder. And they're, based on how it's going, they're really punishing or not punishing at all. And then these supervillains have to come out that immediately attack, and they have more power, and you have to work on that. They also included the assist mechanic, which was in some version of the game. There's a 2v2 version I had played of it. There's so many of them now, I don't know which one's which. But basically, if you're within range of somebody, because it's cooperative, if I didn't mention that, I think I did.
Yeah, the only version we played, because you can play competitive.
Oh, you can play competitive, yeah. So I can play a card that says if Brian's within 2 range of me, I can add +1 to his power on his turn. In terms of all that. So that's the basic gist of it. And I definitely was really excited for it. I liked the idea of co-op. I liked the idea of switching it up. Like, I thought if they could change the formula, they could make it more interesting. But ultimately, the games were so long. We played... The first game didn't feel brutally long to me, but I know Kathy was done.
Oh, post-Gen Con? Like, the one
first
at Gen
game
Con
we played, yeah.
That we played was really... That one felt fairly fast once we got through the, like... The structure of it.
Right.
I think that's the tough thing with this game, too. Like, it's like there are some steps that don't necessarily feel as intuitive. Like, you just kind of have to walk through, you know, the back of the rule book that tells you do this, then do this, then do this. And, you know, you just want to make sure, because it feels like it's just adding another layer to, like, a normal deck building game. So you have to, like, make sure you're doing the stuff that that it tells you to do in the midst of that. But, yeah, no, the one at Gen Con felt fast, and then the ones that we were playing back here did drag out a little bit, you know, and I think part of what I look for in that type of game, like, it was presenting a scenario-based game where you kind of keep leveling up and you advance and progress through the whole thing, and I think with the way the advancements were presented, like, it was very... very minimal, like what you actually did gain. So the steps were small, and I think it was just trying to say, like, here, this is a new way to play this DC deck building game. Enjoy the, like, this structure that you know, and just enjoy the, like, the experience.
Yeah.
And I was looking to enjoy the destination in a sense more.
Right, right, right.
And the experience is really seems to be a little bit more of the focus, and just kind of still playing the normal game. I don't know. I guess maybe adding all the other stuff from the different the different ones would be interesting, but I don't know how you'd even do that with like the leveling up of stuff. But it was definitely fun. It's come down a bit. Like I was excited because I didn't expect much, and I really liked the play at Gen Con, and then it did feel a little repetitive, and it did drag out a bit, but I don't know.
Yeah, our second game, like when we knew what we were doing, mm-hmm. was like 2 hours. And for some games, 2 hours is fine. It's a perfect, but this just felt like it was just so arbitrary. Like, what cards come out? Can I get to them? Most of the time, if you stand on a villain, they don't move, and it felt like you needed to do that. Like you said, your powers weren't necessarily useful, and there was no guarantee you could get cards that played to your power. Mm-hmm. So Brian was talking about, like, in between games you get a level up, but it was literally like I was Superman. It was like, oh, exchange your punch card that's plus one for a card that's like plus one, and if you beat a villain, then you can gain a card at their location. But there weren't even necessarily cards. Like, I don't even remember. We should talk about the fact there was move. There's now move on cards, which is how you move around that space. And sometimes you could like cash in move. Well, you could specifically cash in move.
I was the Flash. Right? Yeah. That made sense. Yeah, so. But yeah, it was very, it was tough to get it to the point, like even the way the cards were coming out, like you were very much dependent on how, how new cards were added to the whole tableau, you know, instead of like, I guess For it to kind of take another step up for me, like, I'd like to see some sort of progression within the deck, even, like, where it's, like, it shuffle ramps up, you start it. Off, and you have cards that you can buy pretty easily. Like, it felt like in certain scenarios, there were these villains that came out that were too difficult to defeat because we had just started the game.
Right.
And there were cards that were too expensive to buy because we had just started the game.
Right. So
then we're stuck getting the negatives of the villains to make us worse, to try to buy the cards that we couldn't buy before the villains even negatively affected us.
Right.
Which was fine. I mean, it's just that's part of that structure of the game, but it didn't seem like it was rewarding us for, like, or like it didn't feel like it was guiding us along in any sort of the word. It was just like presenting everything that was available from beginning to end and just telling you to go with it.
Yeah. And, you know, if somebody said to me, like, wow, as you open up, though, like, by the time you get to the third or the fourth, like, you really get into a game, which you were bringing up the Harry Potter deck building game, which I would agree if people played the first three, I could see them being like, ah, it's okay, unless you're really into the Harry Potter theme. But once you get beyond that, it really becomes, you know, a pretty solid game. Anyway, now I'm reviewing that game. But so if somebody told me that, but I mean the packets are a few cards. I didn't see any packets that were more than maybe 6-8 cards. So it wasn't like there was anything like, oh, once you get here, you're now going to, like almost what you were saying was if you started with a deck that was 50 cards, but by the end it was 150 cards or something, or these 50 got replaced with another 50, that could be cool. But ultimately, it just becomes a game that I'm just not really interested in playing again. I don't have the DC in me. Like, I don't really care about DC. I like those characters, and it'd be fine. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's just kind of like a 5 out of 10. Like, okay, if somebody said they really want to play it, and I'll play it with them, but I would never suggest playing it again.
Yeah.
Cool. I don't remember what we're going to talk about next because I lost track of this. Sierra West.
Yeah. Do you want to do? You know it a bit better. Have you already reviewed it?
I haven't reviewed Sierra West yet. So we should talk about it.
Okay.
But then I forget how it is. Why?
No, you've been talking about it to me for a while now. Yeah. So I feel like you must have reviewed it on the podcast.
Yeah, I can do that, and then
I totally listened to all of the ones.
All right. So Sierra West is a board and dice Euro game. It says 40 to 60 minutes on the box. We played it about that, so we did pretty well, but I think it's a little longer than that. Anyway, it's a, you know, go west, young man game, and you've got a pioneer and frontiersmen and all these things, so you set up kind of like a solitaire pyramid of cards that come out based on scenarios. There's four different scenarios in the box, which do vary, but I feel like the structure of the game still stays. I wouldn't say there's four games in the box. There's just four types of the game in the box. And what you do on your turn, you have a deck of cards, you draw three cards from there, and you basically slot them into your board where you're picking what actions you want to be able to do. And without visually representing that, it's hard to show how that works, but you get used to it relatively quick. But you're able to pick the order, so it's kind of like programming. I would argue it's not really programming because you just do it, so you're just choosing, but action selection. You slot those cards in, and then you've got two pioneers, I believe they're called, and they have some options. They can go to the cabins that you've built, and they can kind of trigger a special action, or they can go to their path. There's a tan and a green path, and they walk down the path, and as they go down the path, they pick up resources. So you've got wood and food and stone, or they'll collect hides from all the animals that you've got, which you get bonuses. Or you might get to a shovel where you have to pay, and if you get a shovel, you can either build a cabin, or if your frontiersman has traveled up that pyramid of cards, you can take one of those cards. Those cards will be worth points at the end of the game, and they'll kind of give you options for like scoring other endgame points. Then you come across just hazards, which are like bears, and you just have to pay to get beyond them. If you then get to the end of your path, you can move up and take a summit action. Usually a summit action is trading in resources to move up on various tracks. There's like a travel track, or like building fences, food, and I don't. The other one's like a gravestone, so I don't know. Yeah. It's supposed to be like memories? I'm not sure. but you move up these tracks where you get resources, and you can score endgame points based on how far you're up the track. The last thing you do is you have a little wagon that moves across the board. Now, the wagon moves east, which I thought was weird. I thought they should have made it move west, but I guess going to the right is moving forward for people, whereas going to the left is not. But thematically, it should go to the left. Anyway, so you have little boots tokens where you can travel. That's how your frontiersman can travel, and also how your wagon can travel. And then you have to trade in resources, and you want to move up because you get a multiplier for where you are on those tracks at the end of the game. That's the basic gist of the game. Then the scenarios present other things. So like the opening one is the apple orchard, where everybody can pick apples and they're communal, and then people can consume the apples for various bonuses. So do I want to collect apples that Brian could then turn in? Not really, but I may be forced to or whatever. So there's some interaction there. Pretty low level, low stakes interaction, but
right.
It exists. So that's the game. One of the key things is all those actions you're doing on your turn, they each pioneer has to go in order, but you can kind of trade and alternate order. So there's just lots and lots of different combinations of things that you can do. So you're kind of tearing through all that. I mean, ultimately, it is a resource collection, resource trade-in game to score points. But I just find the puzzle so exciting. There are absolutely turns where the puzzle is so clear. This is my only possible option. This is exactly the order I have to do it in. It's very clear. But that's not every turn. That's just some of them. And then as you shuffle through your deck, you get more and more actions. I don't think I forgot too many things. You collect gold. There's a donkey that you can get that you can trade gold for wild resources. I don't know. I feel like that's
It's mostly. I think it's mostly
trimmings.
I mean, in my mind, the biggest part would be just utilizing those cards, right, and kind of trying to add to your deck in ways that make sense.
Yep.
And I know, like, the bulk of the thought comes from how do I arrange the three cards that I've drawn on my turn? Like, because they overlap, so there are two on the bottom, and then one that gets tucked underneath.
Yep.
So you've got basically the ones that are on top give you specific actions, and the one that's tucked under gives you another one that might, like a singleton action on the one that's tucked under, and the other two give you a few more things that you collect resources for. I think that's kind of how it works, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem like you're always trying to juggle, like, this one has some really good stuff on this card, and it also has some negatives. Do I want this to have both of those, or do I just want to avoid the negatives and kind of get the benefits from the other two cards? And it felt like that was kind of juggling that was the big part of the game.
Yep.
And it was definitely neat. I feel like in some ways you just kind of have to think, like, you could definitely math the whole thing out and see exactly what you want to. I think you just have to figure out, okay, I really want to do this, so let me just put these down. I feel like it does lead to potentially just being like, oh, kicking yourself after for
definitely
doing something that didn't actually math out to what you wanted. But in some ways, you're also just trying to, like, to gain some points on your turn and leave your options open when your opponent is going as well.
Correct.
And it was fun. It was definitely a lighter, medium like it wasn't like a ton that was going on. I know like just the way the cards kind of work themselves out, like that's a lot of thought, but besides that it's pretty simple, like resource collection, right? And I know like it always felt like we were progressing about the same pace. I know you'd mentioned that, like we were coming to a very similar point value. And as long as you kind of know the structure of the game and what you're trying to do with it, you're probably going to be gaining about the same number of points.
Right.
But at that point, you're having to figure out how to differentiate yourself from the other person still. So it is neat to try to do that and see how to best utilize what you've got and what's available to you.
Yeah, the difference, right, because you start with the same deck, so the difference becomes those cards that you get as you go and explore that mountain or whatever. So that changes all that up. But, yeah, I don't know. It's a game that I really, really enjoy, even though I see some of the, like, eh. Like, it's definitely AP-prone, but the genius of the game is that I'm just thinking about my turn on your turn. So I don't really spend maybe 5 to 7 minutes, I guess, thinking about my turn, but I'm thinking about it on your turn or on other players' turns. There was a lot of times even on your turn I would just commit so I wouldn't forget what I wanted to do. It wasn't a big deal for you to see what it was. Yeah, you did mention like you save resources because you can trap animals that the other player plays on their turn, which is, you know, it's a nice element of it. It's just another thing to do on somebody's turn. It does use up one of your pioneers, so you can't use them for the action, so there's a little bit of choice there. But the entire game, I mean, it's pretty simple to play. It all comes down to those choices that you're making. Right. It very much reminds me of the weight of Castles of Burgundy, because Castle of Burgundy is all about what tile am I going to take, where am I going to put it, how am I going to score it, and when am I going to score. And even though I think Castle of Burgundy is definitely a better game, hands down, it's still that same, like, I would call Castles a light, medium game, like you said, but that thought process is still enough where I'm like, hold on, don't talk to me. I'm thinking about what I want to do, and this game feels that same way. Yeah, I agree. That pioneer track, basically everybody gets to the end,
right?
Or it's a must to get to the end. The tracks you go up aren't very interesting. You just go up them. The apple one presents a little bit more because one of the, like, they give you better benefits, so you're trying to think how to get up those, which is the cards that are out there. The banjo and raccoons one is neat because it has a little market of fish. Then
is
there's,
that the one that you were showing me?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's kind of interesting, although the fish run out, so then you can kind of just corner the market by holding them all and just waiting for that opportune time to turn them all in.
Right.
And the then there's like a gold mine one that I played a little bit of solo where you can like dig up gold and trade things in, and I haven't played the bandit one, bandit one, but there's like a bandits one where you have to, I don't know, they attack, I don't know. But they attack you attack them kind of thing. I don't think it really becomes like an Ameritrash thing. I think it's probably just a trade resources to get rid of them, you know, or protect yourself.
Where do you get most of your points in that game?
The multiplier. The tracks.
Is that most of them?
I guess it was about half of
them. You get
a
lot from like cards too, right?
Right. So the cards, if you get to 5 cards, I believe after that everyone is 5 points or something like that. So you might have had like 8 cards to my 6, and I might have had 30, and you might have had 40, so...
So that's a lot of points. I mean, with the kind of moving up the tracks, I guess that's kind of where, like, the deck that you have gives you, like, each card has something at the top that lets you progress on one of the tracks. It never felt like I was at the point where I knew what I was looking for. I knew what I could buy and hope to just shuffle into my deck, but I never really felt like I was trying to, like, that didn't feel as clear with one play, like, oh, I need to set myself up for this one card in my deck. Granted, I guess I did try to do that with a specific card.
No, I think you do. I think you at least look. I mean, it's more tactical. You look at what cards you're able to get and which one do you think you could set up to get. But I then guess, it does shuffle out. You've got to hope you get it, shuffle through.
I guess in my mind, like, I wasn't like trying to figure out, okay, I added 3 cards in my deck that require stone. So I really need to focus on getting stone. Like, I never really thought that way with the way cards were added. It felt like it was like you stumble into resources on your turn and, oh, hey, I can use them this round to advance on a track. Yeah, great.
Yeah, there's not a lot of long-term planning. Our game was rare, which happens a lot, in that I believe the first 4 cards that we drafted traded apples for resources, not apples for moving up tracks or the apple track. Which, if just the first 2 cards let you move up the apple track, then you start moving up that track, and now you're getting bigger bonuses, and you're thinking towards doing that.
Right.
Whereas it was like, oh, I can just trade a bunch of apples for stone or food, whatever. Which is interesting that you have to trade apples for food. I wonder what the theme is there. They were bad apples, but they could only be used for making apple cider. I don't know. So anyway, I can name the things that I don't like or could potentially be rough in the game, but overall I still really like the game.
Yeah.
It would push for one of my top 10 games of the year. I thought it was really fun, and I'm excited to pull it out and play more, you know, of those scenarios and everything. And even the solo's really good. It's like an Automa style solo, so that was really cool.
Yeah, I'll need to try that out.
Yep. All right. You want to do Black Angel? You could say no.
I mean, if you feel better. I mean, it's basically that was the game that – what did you pick? You picked something weird. We're doomed, right, for Gen Con. Larry and I picked Black Angel as the game of Gen Con. And it's kind of in that just – like it's a heavy Euro game that's basically – if people have played TWA, it's associated with that being in space. I guess that's mostly just because it uses dice in a similar fashion.
Right.
But basically, I think the world has ended, right? So each person is controlling like robots or something like that to go out. Everyone's on a spaceship that's traveling to a distant planet to try to reestablish like humanity or whatnot. So each person is controlling these robots that have what is it, like some DNA or
the genetic code? Yep, DNA.
Genetic code for a specific group of people or something like that. So each person's trying to vie for gaining the most points or being the most prestigious or whatnot out of those factions to try to get the best chance at being the faction that's kind of in charge on this new planet, in a sense. At least that's kind of, I don't know. I might be butchering that, but it's pretty close.
Good. You're going to try to get points.
That's how it felt in the game. But basically you're going through and it plays over a series of rounds. Each round you pick one of two things. Either you use one of the dice that you have available to you, or you kind of reset your board and just roll all the dice that you're allowed to roll and kind of reset. That advances the ship toward the planet. So each time someone resets, which is typically when they've used all their dice, at least from what we've played, every time someone does that, now it's moving one step closer to the end game. And I guess the basic gist of it is there are three different colors of dice, and they range in values from 0 to 3 on them. And whatever you have available to you, the die can be used in that colored area to do one of two things. Either spread out, move one of your personal spaceships off of the main one and kind of go to another planet that we're passing by, or do the action that's associated with that color die. And each one is typically just doing some maintenance within the big spaceship, like removing damage as these other aliens attack, removing the other aliens from the ship, or advancing in our own personal technology that we've got on our board. So yeah, you're going through and just using those dice for whatever function it is, and there's a lot there's a lot more than I'm giving it credit for.
Yep.
And I know I'm skipping over a few parts, but that's really where most of the gameplay comes down. The technologies are pretty huge too. You've got this grid on your board that gives you like 3 to start as you add new technologies that come in on the sides of the board, and you're pushing stuff. So eventually older technologies will be removed from your board and they'll kind of cycle through. But basically you can fill up your grid, your 3x3 grid, and at the start of each of the turns that you're not resetting, you can play a card down and activate all cards in that row or column that match the color of the card. So the key thing to know would be like, colors matter for everything that you're doing.
Yeah.
Everything kind of stacks on whatever whatever color you're using. It does make sense. That's kind of what it'll activate or what you can do or what actions you can trigger, all that sort of stuff. And, yeah, you're just playing through. You're gaining points, you know, a few different ways. It seems like there are some technologies that you can collect that give you endgame points instead of, like, immediate in-game benefits. Some of the ways that you can spread out and go to planets, they let you put down these other bonus cards that give you either resources or points again. You're going through, and I don't know, there's a lot that's kind of going on in it. Like, once you get the flow of it down, like, it does work pretty easily. Like, it's just, it might not be clear what you're trying to do, but you do
right.
get the flow of the game pretty quickly into it.
Yeah, that flow feels very similar to Terra Mystica and Gaia Project. There's all these things you can do, but once you figure out a turn, you're just like, boom, I do this. So right. a turn in of itself gets very straightforward. You get that down. But your what am I going to do is
right.
still abstracted as you're playing. Like, I don't know what the best thing to do is. There's so many options.
Yeah.
You know?
But
which is cool.
Yeah, no, it's definitely like there's a lot going on. The presentation is great.
the production is gorgeous. Yes,
yeah. The art is amazing, and it just seems like it does jump out. Like, it's a game that has great table presence.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I guess we I think I just played the one time since, but it was a two player game, which did seem a little bit different. Like, I don't know. I know when we played at Gen Con, we were playing most of it. I don't think we saw how the end triggered necessarily. We were right. playing through, and we got like a great sense just from that initial impression. I know with the two-player game, it did feel like I don't know, it didn't necessarily jump out in the same way that it did with the three-player game, but I think that was probably just like getting our bearings again, kind of coming back off of the the show. You know, really being able to sit down and play through a whole thing, and you are trying to juggle a lot of stuff, and it's not necessarily clear how your engine's going to come about or how how the system's going to work for you necessarily. So I know, like I guess for me, for example, like I played through and I was trying to set myself up for like a huge turn, but it really wasn't incentivizing that. Like, it was trying to say, just score points consistently throughout the game instead of trying to go above and beyond and do this crazy
right.
epic turn. Like, it was like you just chip away at the scores that you can feasibly get.
Right.
I know, like it's easy to just pick something and do it, but to really figure out what path you're trying to go down, that's where it gets a little tough.
Yeah.
Because you've got all these options available to you, and it can be a little overwhelming. I think it's just, you just have to do something and try it. Hope for the best. Once you kind of have a few games under your belt, I feel like that's kind of when you know you can set yourself up for specific things, and you have a better idea of like how the game's going to end up.
Mm.
But I don't know. Did you liked it? Or
I did. I did enjoy it. I played the much more tactical game when I played with you, and it paid off in spades, because I just hammered one thing.
Right.
Get cards out, score with them. Get cards out, score with them. Not try to maximize them, just get a few points. In fact, there was a few cards that scored less than what I anticipated, but it was still good for me. Like, I'm
right.
just getting scores out. Which was neat. You had really said at the end of the game, you were like, I think it's just ask you to pick a path and go down it, which is great. It would be nice if it kind of let you put two paths together. Like, oh, you could heal the ship and you could explore space, or you could own dice and you could build up your technology, but it felt like you just do one of those and maximize that kind of scoring, or just do a bunch of that, which is nice, but ultimately the timer was a little quicker, ironically, right? Like, I didn't realize the box says 60 minutes for two players. We were probably like 75, 80, I'm guessing,
right.
for our game, but that felt quick. Like, it felt like, oh gosh, it's ending. In fact, you were even the one that was like, no, when this Ravager deck runs out, it's
yeah.
over. And we were like cards away. And I was like, oh, because I was waiting for us to get to Spes, which is in space. And we were even close to that. But that was still like two rounds or turns or something. But with that, Ravager just came up on us like, boom, that, you know?
Yeah, those are the other aliens.
Yes. And so I enjoyed it. But when I thought back on it more, I was like, yeah, no, I want to play that again. Like, I definitely want to try that with 3 and 4 and see what happens. And the stuff I was thinking about was awesome. Like, it was super fun to try to figure out what all the things were. And once you get the flow of the game, you're not worrying about how a turn works. You're just doing everything. You're just doing it and trying to put it all together. I do think if you're going to compare it to TWA, which it really just is not TWA.
Right.
Other than the dice. If people like this type of game, they're just... I would imagine most people are going to like TWA better. And I know TWA got a reprint like a year or two ago, so it's probably somewhat available. But, hey, if people go and play Black Angel and love it, then seek out TWA.
I think
I love the purchasing dice from people and all that in there, but they they verge enough that you could definitely own both.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, they just have that dice mechanism and have the same designers. But Trois just has a lot more tightness to it, whereas Black Angel is just asking you to go do your thing.
Right. It's just setting it up and presenting this open space whereas Trois is kind of giving you, you know, like a beginning and an end in sight.
Yeah.
I feel like this one's kind of just presenting whatever, just get points somehow.
Yeah. And for a Euro game especially, way higher levels of interaction in Trois. I mean, very simply, Trois was one of the first games I ever played where it was everybody has a secret end game and everybody will score that.
Right.
So I'm just trying to figure out what you're doing so I could try to score points off of it.
Yeah.
You know, which is kind of interesting. But I don't always think it's fair to just if you compare these two, own this one. Like, I think they're both great. And the production is way better. The Trois art often gets kind of put down, which I don't think it's terrible, but it's not exciting like Black Angel is on the table.
Right. Yeah, no,
so
it doesn't.
From that end, you know.
Yeah, the presentation wouldn't sell it. You'd have to know, like, someone would have to come in and know that Trois is a great game.
Right.
Whereas this one, I feel like it just jumps out. Yeah. And it just seems like a no-brainer for people that are looking for that next one, the next heavier game that does give you, you know, a good amount of options. So,
and I don't know that Black Angel would be one of my top 10 of the year, but I would pretty much imagine that I'll play it 4 more times this year. So, like, it's a plenty good game that I'm looking forward to playing more.
So Sierra West is on there, but Black Angel is not?
Yes.
All right. How about DC Deck Builder?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to scratch the other game we're going to talk about because I realize there's a game I have to talk about.
Uh-oh.
One of my favorite games I've played this year. It is not a 2019 game.
Fleet the Dice game?
I got to talk about Fleet. Okay. Has anybody heard me talk about Fleet the Dice? All right. No, I acquired a copy of Sword and Sorcery.
Okay, yeah.
And this is from Ares Games. I think it's 2016 or 2017, one of those. It's a dungeon crawl. So Gloomhaven is my favorite game of all time. And I guess Sword and Sorcery gets compared. It doesn't really feel like people talk about them. But I've heard people, solo board gamer channel, whatever, oh, like, Gloomhaven's fine, but Sword and Sorcery is where it's at. I love this game, Brian. It is so good. Now, you've already heard me gush because you've heard me talk about it post, but we'll pretend this is new. Sword and Sorcery is a dice-rolling, story-based dungeon crawl game with all sorts of bells and whistles and different things, and it's pulling off of those moments. It's not nearly the same mechanical game. It does everything right that Gloomhaven doesn't do. And it doesn't do the things that Gloomhaven does. I still like Gloomhaven better, for sure, because that puzzle of here's my whole deck of cards, which is, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 cards, whatever it is, not a ton, but I love that Gloomhaven gives you all those cards and you have to pick the two and work with the other people and figure it out. That's amazing. That's an amazing puzzle to do. But Sword and Sorcery just does things I didn't expect. It does those little story moments, like, oh, when you get to this waypoint, read this thing in the book. I hate that stuff normally, right? We played Abomination, and I was annoyed at Gen Con. Like, why are we reading this passage? And then you get a coin. Like, that stuff bothers me sometimes. Like, what's the final result? This game did it so well. I don't remember a lot of specific, and I guess I don't want to spoil. I don't really care about spoils. It's like a dungeon crawl game. But it would just be like, oh, go in the box and get this troll out of the box, and they show up, and suddenly you've got the card. And the AI is phenomenal. Whereas the AI in Gloomhaven is really good because all the decks are unique, and these monsters will only do certain things, that you kind of start to learn that type of monster. So again, that becomes a little like Euro, like, oh, these monsters only attack at range, and these ones do this. These ones are very specific. If they're at this range, they do this, and there's a blue version of the troll, and there's no trolls. A blue version of the gremlin, and a red version of the gremlin, and a green version of the gremlin, and they come out, and you draw random ones, and then there's a deck of special power. I mean, it's all that Ameritrash stuff, right? Random this, random that, random this, movement, but you can predict their pattern. And it's tough. Like, it's hard. Like, you're taking damage, and you're trying to get through this dungeon. There is, a lot of healing, and there's a lot of negating. And you roll dice, but it doesn't bother me. Because it's, like, it gives you guaranteed hits plus what you roll, which is always a great way in my mind to do it. I'm at least going to have three, and then probability says I might get to here, and there's mitigation and special powers. I would say one of my biggest – one of the things I was least excited about was, like, the upgrading of equipment isn't amazing, but the leveling up is awesome. You get, like, a whole new power that you can use, and you've got more health. Like, it feels great when you level up, and you can level up, boom, right in the middle of a of a mission. But the story moments were phenomenal. Like, I loved reading the story, and the story made sense. It was very cohesive. I did make a mistake at the end. It branches into two stories, and I went to the wrong one. I ended up having to clean it up because it was out on the dining room table for, like, a week.
Yeah.
And I had to eventually put it away, and I finished the wrong half of the story. But I was like, I'm going to go back and play this. So I'm really intrigued, you, Larry, Kathy, whoever, playing this with me. It feels like one of those games that I'm going to herald, that I'm going to like better than everybody else. And I don't know that Kathy and I have a reason to play it when we still have Gloomhaven. But it does it all opposite. It's all story and dice and just find random treasures and immediately put them on. Like, it's just very on that front. And I guess from here it goes, there's a, like, this is Act 1, and then there's an Act 2 box. There's another box, which is like side quests of Act 1.
Yeah, it's all confusing.
And then there's a ton of characters you can get, which is cool because they come with special cards and everything, and they're not expensive. They're like $13 retail with the mini and everything. I just don't know how many characters. Like, I was playing two characters. I could see the joy of playing three for a little more interaction. But I don't know that I need to play the game, you know, that many times. And there's only, like I said, there's seven quests. You go through six to win. So there's not, like, you'd say, like, oh, there's not a lot of replayability, but you can play good, you can play bad, you can make different choices next time. I don't know. I was shocked how much I love the game, and I have not enjoyed solo gaming this year very much. I haven't been a huge solo gamer. I'm more playing solo to learn the game.
Right.
I had a blast. I loved this game. I could leave it and remember where I was.
And you were looking forward to it, too. Like, this game specifically. So it lived up...
Absolutely. The game was wonderful.
Okay.
So I'm really excited to play with other people and see if it slows down, if it bogs down. If I'm playing one of three characters, do I feel like I'm just not nearly as invested as when I was playing two characters fully and making their decisions? But I don't think decisions is where this game shines, which is what Gloomhaven exactly shines on. Like, the decisions just... are so good, and the building of my deck. Like, I know I'm building this deck to do exactly this. I'm making a character. It feels like a WoW character, right? A World of Warcraft. I know exactly what the rotation is going to be for this character and how it's going to work and what it's going to do well. And my go-tos, that's what Gloomhaven is. This is like, oh, okay, let me try this, right? But that was really enjoyable, where I don't always like that. But there it is. So I just really enjoyed Sword and Sorcery, and I'm looking forward to playing with other people and then diving into those other boxes, which I don't even think Act 3 is out yet. I think it's eventually going to be three acts.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple bigger expansions out, I think, but I don't
one's
know.
One's a side quest expansion and one's so Act 2.
That's what it is.
So I guess Act 3 is in the works. I don't know. They did a Kickstarter. I don't know if people could back everything and get it slowly. I have no idea, but we have it here. So
yeah, but either way, the base game was great to just – play through and
phenomenal. Is it fiddly to set up? Yeah, but once you learn what all the tokens are, if you just sort them just a little bit like baggies,
okay,
it's not bad. The insert isn't great, so you could just pull it, even though it holds cards and it holds stuff, it's pretty tight.
Yeah,
so I could see just pulling that and just bagging stuff up, but then you're good. Like, it's not that bad to set up in terms of, and the tiles are so cool because they're not just like boom, boom, boom. It's not a grid. They'll have like a tile that, like, in the middle of the tile, there's like a diagonal hallway and you can walk up onto like a throne. I don't know. There's just cool elements within the tile that don't make it just your standard grid. It's not a grid. They're like whole spaces. I don't know. It was so good.
Really good.
It was so good. I would just tell people to go play it. I mean, if Dungeon Crawl is of interest to you, if you think that a good story would draw you in, then it's good. Like, an interesting and like, ooh, they just always do something innovative. Because when you lay the map out, you're like, oh, there's nothing here. This looks like any standard map. But then when you start playing it, you're like, oh, okay, I wouldn't have thought of this. Like, that's cool. I like this idea. We got to split up, or we're going to add a piece to the map, or we're defending something. Like, they add just enough. It's not so outside the box. You're like, I've never seen this before, but it's just, it works great. So
nice.
I loved it. I loved reading the story moments. Like, they were perfect. They were well written. There's a little bit weird. They reference pop culture too much. They reference
in
a
the
lot.
Rules specifically?
Yeah, in those reading. Like, okay. They will say lines from Lord of the Rings a lot. Like, word for word, which almost feels... And it's just weird if you know those lines. You're like, huh, that's strange. So that's the one poor part that pulls you out of the story. But otherwise, it's good. Nice. Yeah, the whole thing is like, you're dead. And this world is going to ruin, so something resurrects you back to life.
And then you just have to figure out what
and you
to
have
do.
No weapons. So in the first quest, you just step on a spot. And they're like, grab some weapons, heroes. Like, it's just cool. It feels like a video game almost. You're like, okay, I appear here. I've got nothing. This is just my character. And then all of a sudden, what do I do? And as you step forward on the spot, it's like, here's your weapon. You're like, oh, cool. Okay. I wouldn't have thought of that. I would have figured I would go through the weapons one at a time and pick stuff out.
You have to fight like a lion or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Collect everything.
It was great. I'm gushing, obviously. It was one of my favorite games. I don't even know if I rated 2017, 2016. I'd have to go back on a top 10, but it would definitely be up there, and it'd be interesting to see where it falls in my favorite games of all time. But that is really going to hinge on playing it with other people.
Okay.
And seeing if they enjoy it. Because solo, I'll play it, but how, you know, am I going to play the thing more than twice by myself? Not necessarily. Am I going to get those new boxes? Yeah.
At some point.
Is that good? Yeah. Yeah. It's a no-brainer.
So now that you talked about an old game, can I talk about a game coming out next year?
Yes.
No, so we had a Kapow tournament a while ago, right? So that was made up of like three local designers came out and really just did a great job. And, you know, there's a lot of traction, especially within, you know, within this area. And one of the designers from Kapow actually has a game up on Kickstarter, I believe still going right now.
Yep.
And that's Merchant's Cove. So that's going to be coming out. It looks like it's supposed to be releasing next year. But the big draw on this game is everyone is playing with a different character that's making the game completely unique. Like, whatever they're trying to do is completely unique to what their character is. So I know with what we had done set up, like I had an alchemist and someone else was someone was working a forge. There was a captain that was going out to fish. And there was a basically a time traveler sort of guy. So each person has their own player board, their own player power, and they're playing the game to try to create items to eventually sell to this common pool of people that are coming into town. So it starts off, and there's like this general, like the player board in the middle of the table, right? And it's got six boats on there each boat has four seats. We seated each boat with two meeples of whatever colors. Like, we just pulled them out from a bag. I think there are, like, five different colors that they could be. And four of them work kind of similarly. The black meeples are the rogues, which just function a little different. That's not a huge deal, but just that is a different side of it. But whatever the colored meeples are, two go on each boat, and that's the type of good that they're going to want to – that's the color good that they're going to want to buy if they come into the merchant area of town, right? So we're going through. There's a time track that's really got – everyone starts off. They've got a pillar piece on there in their color. And whoever's on top of that stack or whatever – like, sorry, let me reset. So whoever's farthest behind on that circular track – will be that's that person's turn, right? So whoever's turn it is, they'll go, they'll take actions within their own player board and advance however many steps on that track based on what action they do. Now it goes through, the next person who goes is either the person on the top of the stack of discs or the person farthest behind again, whichever one is actually, like if there's no one that's on their own, then it's just the highest stack farthest back. So you're going through. On your player board, you've got a couple different things that are pretty common. Like, each person can recruit villagers from the town to have them come in and work within their facility or whatnot. Everyone has that where they can attract the people from town, which are just their cards that are out in the middle of the board, not the meeples. Mm-hmm. So you can bring in a card, take one, put it on your player board. And then there's another action that everyone can do, which is basically activating all the workers that they have in front of them. But then besides that, the other actions that you take are different. And that's how you craft the goods that you're trying to sell to these meeples that are coming into town. Right? So you're going through. And for example, I was the alchemist. So I had this tray of marbles, kind of like a potion explosion sort of thing, where I could pull from... from that tray, and then it'll cause marbles to fall down, and based on what color I pick, then I'll kind of ramp up, and if I pick a color that'll keep falling down into that that track, I keep getting more of those marbles. So however many times that color comes up in that row, I'm going to get those marbles to kind of send into some cauldrons and make some potions eventually. But basically my action would be take marbles, and then once I take those, I put them into the cauldrons. Mm-hmm. Another action could be create whatever potions I have from the cauldrons. Each cauldron, I think there are four of them that I have available. So whatever marbles are sitting in there, that's what I can craft. So I'd need two of the same color marble in one cauldron to make a small potion. If I had two of the same color plus a third marble of any color, now I can make a large potion. Mm-hmm. And those are the two main things that I can craft. So I'm trying to do that. And if I had two blues in one and made a small blue potion, now that'll go into my available goods to sell. It'll go through. As soon as the people come into town, if there are blue meeples looking for small blue small blue items, then I can sell that to them, right?
Hi, I'm a blue people. Blue meeple, I'm looking for a small blue potion.
I mean, that's how we sell stuff to people here, right? Any blue people walking through the door, we got blue games for them. You go through and you just play till four of the boats come in and dock in the sails area. The two that haven't docked will still have meeples on them. Those meeples will go all the way past. They'll skip. They're not buying anything, but they're going in to their regions in the player board, and that'll affect endgame scoring based on what colors are seated in those zones. Mm-hmm. But then you kind of reset. The boats go back. You add two meeples in each boat, and then you play through again. Eventually, as soon as a boat is filled up with the four meeples, that's when you bring it into the harbor to, mm-hmm. to go in and buy stuff. But it was definitely, there was a lot of stuff going on, with each person doing a separate thing, but it was definitely not overwhelming. It was easy to just kind of give, we got a brief overview of the gameplay, and then, each player board was pretty self-explanatory, okay. Once you figured out how to really abuse it. There was one, the time traveler guy, he was probably the heaviest one, in the sense that, there's a lot more going on with his player board, but even then it wasn't completely overwhelming. There was a lot more stuff that he could do and a lot of things to kind of manipulate how his actions could be done. But besides that, they were all kind of in that similar vein of you're trying to either create small items or big items and eventually sell them to those meeples that are coming into town. And it was a great way to just figure out your own puzzle and try to play the table, see which items other people were going for, mm-hmm. and try to either piggyback off of that or go down a completely different path and mess them up. Each character does seem like you've got a good amount of stuff to explore, and then it was a great experience. I know there are a couple more expansions that are up there as well that add additional characters. So we played with probably the four, I think it was the four in the base game that you kind of, they probably have the, I don't know if they're the most cohesive together or whatnot, but it seemed like they were the ones that were just out there and it made sense. It was an easy way to just hop right in and play it. So I'm looking forward to trying out some of the other ones as well, but it was a great playthrough, and we did back it as the store.
Okay.
So if people are interested in it and we need to up our pre-order quantities, just let us know. I guess if you email us, Brant will tell me to boost the quantities.
PortalGamePodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, it's great. I'm looking forward to it. And I believe it's on BGG. It's got it for 2020. So.
Okay. Cool. So that's Merchant's Cove.
Merchant's Cove.
By Carl Van Ostrand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Final Frontier Games.
Yep.
Cool. And that's on Kickstarter now. And it'll be in retail in 2020 with us. Yeah. So we'll have that. Cool, yeah, I totally wanted to play that game, and I was upside down at a carnival with my 4.5-year-old, and that had to come first, so hopefully I'll get a chance to try it since he's local, because it sounds really, really good. So I'm excited for that, and I know Rotto was excited about it. I don't remember some of the other reviewers that saw it, but yeah, that's kind of neat to have that. Awesome, we're just going to jump right into our little segment, because it's just going to be a little bit. So we were referencing Tapestry at the start, and I think... So Tapestry is a new Civ game, Civ Lite, whatever it is, and it's from Stonemaier Games. So this is the follow-up or the next game after Wingspan, which obviously, you know, won Kenner Spiel des Jahres and all this critical acclaim and whatnot. And I believe this is the third game that Jamie has now done this with. That's Jamie Stegmaier, who is Stonemaier. I believe it was between two castles of Mad King Ludwig, then Wingspan, and now Tapestry, where he's done this model where he doesn't say anything about the game. It gets made, it gets produced, it gets shipped over, and then basically once he knows it's in the country or in not quite distribution, but close, he then announces the game, shows off all these things, has copies for reviewers, and just kind of gets this like 1 month thing going till pre-orders, and then I think about a month after pre-orders, it comes out to people. I very much remember that with Wingspan. I remember him talking about it with Between Two Castles, which was exciting that he did it, but I don't think that game made quite the splash. I mean, it definitely made a splash, but it wasn't like Wingspan in terms of all that. And so now he did this with Tapestry. So there's two elements that I want to talk about. One is, how is that for retail? Or just how do we feel about that in terms of the way that that handled? And then the other is just kind of the media piece, where he basically put an embargo up that was this week, and he said no reviews can go up, you know, until this date, and he handed it to people and said, but you need to play this game multiple times before you review it, and that's what he really wanted. And there were some people that were, you know, positive on that, others that were negative. I know Tom Vassell said that he didn't take a copy because he didn't want to promise that he could do that. Some people took that as like Tom was saying, no, I won't do that, like I won't listen to your demands, which I definitely think is a Tom Vassell thing to do. I think he was more just saying, look, I'm not going to make a promise that I don't think I can keep, so I'm not going to do that. And then I saw people kind of saying negatively, like, it's building this hype bubble in this engine, and all these reviewers would never say anything bad. And I commented and kind of said, maybe the game is good. Like, maybe the reason they said it was good wasn't because they wanted to say – they felt inclined to say it was good, but it was good. And I always get interested in this when people want people to say bad things about games of people who are gamers in the hobby. Like, I don't feel like I would be in this hobby – if 65% of games were bad to me.
Right.
Like, I guess I could just take the 35% I like and make a collection and play them, but I wouldn't be consuming media, looking up reviews on BGG. I'd just be playing those games that I like.
Right. So, well, it gets to a point, too, where there are so many games that are good, like,
right,
you know, something that isn't as good as another game, like,
right,
you're still going to speak. Like, you're going to speak well on something like that. Like, you're just going to talk through it and give it positive reviews. But it's tough when, you know, the majority of games are above the line in some ways. And how do you differentiate there? Like, you know, something that you probably will never play again, even if it's really good. Like,
yep.
I don't know. It's tough to know.
Sure. And consumers are trying to, right? They're trying to figure out what to do with their dollars.
Right.
And so they want a reason to say, like, okay, cool, I can write the $100 Tapestry game off. That right. feels good. Okay, I know that game, nobody's gaga, so I don't have to worry about it. It also could be people who played Wingspan and just found it too light or too the egg thing was a big deal, whatever it was, right? Like, they didn't get into the aesthetic. They didn't get into the production. They didn't get into birds.
Right.
Like, the engine build was too simple for them. They wanted Terraforming Mars, right? Or Fleet the Dice Game. I had to say it. It makes sense to me that people would want to be really, really critical. If I'm going to put my hard-earned $100 out there, is it worth it? Will it get played? On that front. But what about the distribution model for us, like in terms of it all
right.
building up that way?
Yeah, I mean, Stonemaier Games is a tough one to figure out anyway, right? So Scythe is the one that's like, that was, you know, kickstarted, right, way back when, and it's cyclical when that has been available to us. Like, I don't feel like it's ever been fully saturated with just, oh, we know we can order it and bring it in whenever we want. It did feel like it would be brought in, and then it would sell through, and then there would be a gap where we couldn't get it.
Right.
You know, and like there, like that was one that had staying power where people are still looking to buy it to this day, right? And then there's something like Euphoria, which I feel like was the next, or I guess Viticulture was in there too, right? Viticulture was in the same boat.
Side, yeah.
Viticulture was even prior to that, but Scythe is the one that kind of brought them up to that next level in my mind.
Absolutely.
And then, like, Euphoria was also solid, but it wasn't, like, you know, it wasn't as consistent. And I feel like I wouldn't be surprised if we brought one in if it sat for a bit. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other two would be a little bit more, you know, they'd come off the shelf pretty quickly. Between Two Castles and Mad King Ludwig is kind of in the same boat of Euphoria. Like, I feel like it was a little exciting, but it was not, like, it didn't have anything major behind it. But then Wingspan was kind of...
yeah.
Like
impossible to get.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if everything were to function the way Wingspan functioned, right, it would not be good for us.
Right? Right.
And in some ways, like... I don't know, it's tough to know, because Wingspan was just such a weird game, and I feel like I don't know where Tapestry is going to come out, right? If it does follow the same model, like if Wingspan is an indicator of Tapestry, then we should go out and order, like, you know, right, cases of whatever. Yeah. But like, I don't get the same sense.
It's $100 game,
right? It's more expensive. It's a different
game?
Thing.
So like it's literally double.
Yeah.
Not literally double, sorry. I can do math.
but either way, so Wingspan, I guess the problem with that, right? Like we found out about it pretty close to when the pre-order cutoffs were, because the lead time was very small.
Right.
And I think in some ways that makes it tough for retailers. But if it were not that way and we had normal lead time, I don't think it would change our decision. Like, I don't think the normal lead time would net anything. Maybe it would help for distributors if they were getting a sense that other retailers were mm-hmm. boosting quantities. But, like, but we don't have people coming in every day saying, hey, I want to pre-order this.
Right.
Like, we'll typically have some regulars that we know, okay, this person's going to be, you know, basically anything from this company, they're going to be doing this. They'll get all these games from this system or this company. But, you know, like, on a day-to-day, like, board games are still a somewhat small part of what we've got. I mean, it's a decent portion, but it's not, like,
right.
the only thing that the business drives on, right? Like, there are a lot of other things between Magic and miniatures and all that sort of stuff. Like, board games are definitely what I like the most out of it. But,
and they consume the largest shelf space in right. our store. Because of their size, mm-hmm. right, and just because of quantities of what you have to have of things.
Right.
Whereas having, you know, 300 packs of Magic on hand is nothing. It's the right. tiniest amount of space.
Yeah, and I think, I guess that's going into a whole different thing, yeah, right? Like, right. board games are just an easy way to give someone an experience within a box. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is what this is going to do. You're not starting down a path to become full-fledged into a specific game or a specific system or whatnot. Like, you're definitely playing. You can just play it a few times and then be done with it, or you can keep playing it over and over again and just whatever. Like, you can kind of get what you want out of a board game. Whereas I feel like other hobbies, you're definitely going down, and you, if you want to go full-fledged into it, you can, but you're going to be going, and that's kind of what you're dedicating your time to, right? But I don't know. I guess with Wingspan, like, we got a few copies. We put in some pre-orders. We never go too crazy on what we pre-order. But even from what we did put in, like, we were pretty heavily allocated, which right. is not the normal case. Like, most of the time, if we put in a quantity ahead of time before they cut off pre-orders, we know we're going to be getting that number.
Right.
You know, granted, there are some rare instances of, like I think, which one was it? Caverna or something like that. There was, like, a wood shortage or something around the same That's time. Right. So we got allocated at that point. But besides that, I don't remember another game that we did have a severe reduction in quantity yeah. based on something like that. So Wingspan was just spread too thin, where I feel like the lead time for distribution was so light that, like, now all of a sudden all the retailers are putting their orders in, and all of a sudden we can't shut off this whole pre-order system in time. Oh, now we've oversold it, So we have to portion it out based on
right.
whatever priorities they use. So, and then the lead time to get another copy was pretty long. And that's just normal. Like, I mean, it takes a while for stuff to get over here from being produced and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it doesn't do much for us. And then the secondary market, like Wingspan was being sold. And, like, you know, like I remember just we brought the copy that we got in over to, like, for an event for the library because it felt weird to, like,
sell it,
to just put it up on the shelf and the first person through the door just grabs it and can either make profit on their own or maybe they'd go home and play it. I don't know. Like, it's not really up to what people are looking for. But
yeah.
When it was such a hot commodity, it took a whole different form of, like, why people wanted it.
Yeah. So it's tough to know, like, so hype is good because it's kind of fun, and it's fun to see everybody talking about the game and kind of being part of that. But you would never want hype to be like, oh, you got to get a copy of Tapestry because everybody's getting Tapestry or Wingspan, right, whatever. So you wouldn't want to do that from a retail. Like, you got to get it because everybody's getting it.
Mm-hmm.
But then, when it's so much hype that now you can't get the game as a retailer, now you're talking about it with people or people are talking about it in your store, and you can't be part of that chain, really of no lack of fault of your own. Right?
Right.
Like you said, with Wingspan, when we pre-order whatever it is, 6, 10, 12, and basically get allocated 0 or 1.
Right.
Like, at that point, now you're not part of it. So it's tricky. So it's trying to figure out, okay, Tapestry won't be as popular as Wingspan, but will be. It's a $100 price tag. So then what do you put in for that? And we don't know. I'm guessing that Jamie has announced how many copies he actually had produced, and I'm guessing it's probably 15,000, you know, I'm guessing, I don't know, Wingspan was 10 initially, could have been 25, right, and more. I don't know what he did with Tapestry, so I don't want to say but I'm guessing he announced he's usually pretty transparent about that.
Right.
I'm imagining the higher cost. So hopefully he produced more knowing there'd be hype, but of course for him it could be the same thing. People are like, well, I couldn't get Wingspan, it didn't pan out, I you know what I mean? $100 is too much. So it's interesting to see where that'll kind of put us in terms of finding all those things, but.
Sorry, I'm going to check to see if Wingspan is available right now.
Yeah, it's kind of idea. So, you know, we are a store podcast. I try to bring up some of those things. I just thought this was a spot where it's kind of like we could talk about the media piece, which is a little bit more me, and we could talk about just kind of that store retail piece. So, I mean, it never hurts for a game to have hype because that's what we want so that it sells. But we don't want to sell a game just because we have hype. We want to sell a game because it's good.
Right.
People had a good experience. They liked the game. They want to come back, find more games from us. Or find more experiences from us, or like being around here, and just, right, just that idea that, hey, we were the place, and we're doing that lead work. I mean, it's part of why we go to Gen Con. We'll do the lead work right. to find the things, to bring them back, you know, and help people.
Well, it's also amazing, like, you know, like, there are definitely some companies that have it down, like, based on either, you know, just experience or their size or whatever. I guess I'm just picturing, like, everything under Asmodee's umbrella.
Right.
Like, they've kind of got this structure of, you know, this is when it's announced, this is when it's going to be released, and this is how we're going to, what avenues we're going to go out about doing that, right? Like, I guess they're big enough where they have people dedicated to really figuring that out. But
sure.
I feel like for the most part, all the board game companies that that are smaller than that, like, they're trying to figure out what the solution or what they're trying to figure out what to do as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's so much trial and error that goes about it because there isn't one answer that works all the time.
Yeah.
And that's just the tough thing about, I mean, that's kind of a lot of capitalism anyway, right?
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
Just like trying to figure that out is difficult. And I guess it's all, you know, like we do some trial and error and it's all kind of, a lot of it's even just based on your gut.
Yep.
Like, which stuff is going to be great, which stuff is going to be okay, which stuff is not. And we can do the work to figure out if it's good or bad. But even then, like, it doesn't mean it's going to sell or not. Right.
There you go.
That's the tough.
So that's that. You can let us know what you think about Tapestry, if you pre-ordered, what you're thinking about it, and all those kind of things. But there's just kind of a little bit into that. I think we'll have the episode there, Brian.
Yeah, how long was that?
We're like over an hour.
Oh, nice.
Any last words?
Well, if people want to order Tapestry, let us know as soon as possible.
That's right, because who knows where that'll go. That'll be interesting to see. All right, cool. Well, with that, we will wrap up this episode, episode number 135. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. I have been your host, The Brant.
And I'm your co-host, Brian.
And until next time, we hope you step into the portal. Portal Game Podcast, a proud member. Nope. Well, we're a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. It's also a product of the Time Machine Toy and Hobby Store / The Portal, which is located at 71 and 60 Hilliard Street in Manchester, Connecticut. This episode was recorded on September 5th, 2019. Please send any questions to us at portalgamingpodcast@gmail.com. For more awesome podcasts, visit www.dicetowernetwork.com. Hey, thanks for listening.